Good morning. Good to see each one of you here on this beautiful Sunday morning, Mother's Day. I want the moms to know that I specially ordered today for you. But, you know, it's interesting, you know, Friday, pouring down rain. Yesterday, kind of cold. But look at the day. Look at 24 hours. What a difference 24 hours can make. And really, in life, we recognize that all the time, that 24 hours, anything can happen within 24 hours. Usually, we remember the hard things, the more difficult things, maybe an accident that has happened for you. One day, you're healthy, and the next day, you're going to, you know, into surgery and having physical therapy because of an accident. Or maybe everything seems great and wonderful, and you lose your job. And then your whole world seems to crumble. Remember in 2001, 9/11, the beautiful morning. I was taking the day off, and I dropped the kids off at school, and I had Connor with me, and we were at JCPenney's. I was buying socks. I had not listened to the radio all morning. And I noticed everybody was acting kind of strange. So I told Connor, I said, maybe we should go find out what's going on. And within moments, things have changed. World views changed. Sometimes good things happen. Sometimes you feel like you're at your wit's end and financially, and then you get a promotion or get a job that pays better. Or maybe you've been sick and the doctor comes with good news about your sickness. It is amazing how our entire world can hinge on just something that happens within a few minutes. And we see that, actually, in the book of Esther. So if you have your Bibles, I'd like you to open up to Esther chapter 5. But if you remember, Esther is about the Jewish people living in Persia at the time of King Xerxes. Now, in the Bible, most Bibles translate the king's name as Ahasuerus. But you can also just mentally say Xerxes. It's the same person. And during King Xerxes' time, he had a queen named Vashti, whom he exiled, banished from the kingdom. Esther, young woman who was brought in and made queen. Now, as we've progressed through the book, we've discovered that she has that her favor with the king seems to have diminished somewhat. And there's been this plot by Haman to destroy her people, the Jewish people in Persia, because he has this grudge against her cousin Mordecai. Instead of just focusing on Mordecai, he's decided to do away with all of the Jews. And he got King Xerxes to go along with it. So Mordecai challenges Esther to come and, you're the queen, do something about this. Now's the time. And she responds in fear. Mordecai presses her and says, you might be afraid, but if you don't do something, God will deliver his people, but you're not going to be a part of it. So she decides that she would follow through and seek God's guidance to see what God would do about delivering her people. Now, she knows if she goes to the king unannounced that the penalty for that is death unless he extends his scepter to her. So that's why she was afraid to go. And when she arrived last week, if you were here, we saw she arrives, the king extends his scepter to her, she comes in, and he asks her, what do you want, my queen? You tell me, and up to half of my kingdom, I will give it to you. And she invited him and her enemy, Haman, to dinner. And that's where we left last week. So we're going to pick it up with chapter 5, verse 9. Because during that dinner time, the king looked at Esther again and says, whatever you want, you name it, up to half of my kingdom. And she didn't say, well, you know, this guy Haman, you know, he's trying to kill my people. She didn't say that. She says, well, I'd like for you and Haman come back to dinner tomorrow night, and then I'll tell you. And the king granted that request. Well, Haman was excited. Haman just got to spend a quiet evening in the queen's palace, having dinner with the king and queen of Persia. Kind of like the president and the first lady, only inviting you. Of all the Americans in the United States, you're the one that they want to have dinner with. So he's excited. He's political. He has been promoting upward. So here he is. He's with the king and the queen. And it goes on, and he says this. And Haman went out that day joyful and glad of heart. So here he is. He's excited. He's just coming out of the Persian White House, all a Twitter. But then when Haman saw Mordecai in the king's gate, that he neither rose or trembled before him, he was filled with wrath against Mordecai. So here it is. He's just had this amazing moment. He sees Mordecai, who won't bow down to him. Everybody else bows down to him, but Mordecai doesn't bow down to him, and he's incensed. Nevertheless, Haman restrained himself and went home, and he sent and brought his friends and his wife Zeresh. Now, notice the next verses. Haman says, Haman recounted to them the splendor of his riches, the number of his sons, all the promotions which the king had honored him, and how he advanced him above the officials and the servants of the king. Now, he's kind of doing what Xerxes did at the beginning of the book. Xerxes had these meals that he exalted himself and wanted people to see his splendor, his greatness, because he wanted to lead them into battle against Greece. So he's showing all of his wealth and all of his riches. And so here Haman is doing the same thing. He's talking about his wealth. He's talking about his sons. He's talking about how he's been promoted. And then Haman says, even Queen Esther, let no one but me come with the king to the feast she prepared. And tomorrow also I am invited by her together with the king. So, you know, I had dinner with them. They like me so much, I'm going back. Verse 13, yet all of this is worth nothing to me, so long as I see Mordecai the Jew sitting at the king's gate. Okay, everyone else bows down to him in the kingdom. He's second to the king. He just had this great dinner with the king and queen. He sees Mordecai, and he's all upset. Do you know people who seem everything is going right, but they're obsessed about that one thing, or that two little things? They're unhappy. You look at their lives, and you think, wow. You have a loving spouse, you have a loving family, you have a great place to live, and you're worried about this? This is what you're worried about? And this is Haman. Then his wife Zeresh and all of his friends said to him, let a gallows 50 cubits high be made, and in the morning tell the king to have Mordecai hanged upon it. Then go joyfully with the king to the feast. The idea pleased Haman. And he had the gallows made 70 feet high in order to show, make sure everybody could see Mordecai, his dreaded enemy, the guy who would not bow down to him, hanging from these gallows. And he says, yeah, I'm going to go to the king first thing in the morning, and I'm going to tell him, let's hang Mordecai. All right, now let's look at Esther 6. On that night, the king could not sleep, and he gave orders to bring the book of memorable deeds, the Chronicles, and they were read before the king. And it was found written how Mordecai had told about Bithana and Teresh, two of the king's eunuchs, who guarded the threshold, and who had sought to lay hands on King Ahasuerus, that means to assassinate him. And the king said, what honor or distinction has been bestowed on Mordecai for this? The king's young men who attended him said, nothing has been done for him. And the king's pondering this, and he's up. He's up all night. Haman is now coming in early in the morning because he's on a mission. He wants to talk to the king about Mordecai. The king wants to talk to Haman about Mordecai. Two different agendas. We see the work of God and the
will of man about to collide here. So, and the king said, well, who's in the court? Now, Haman had just entered the outer court of the king's palace to speak to the king about having Mordecai hanged on the gallows that he had prepared for him. So he's all excited. He's like, oh, I got this great plan. And the king's young men told him, Haman is there standing in court. And the king said, let him come in. So Haman came in, and the king said to him, what should be done to the man whom the king delights to honor? Now Haman, being the humble man that he is, he immediately thinks to himself, whom would the king delight to honor more than me? He's got to be talking about me. So he's standing there and he's thinking, you know, his mind is now going a million miles a minute, and he says, and he says to the king, well, for the man whom the king delights to honor, let the robes be brought which the king has worn, and the horse that the king has ridden, and on whose head a royal crown is set. And let the robes and the horse be handed over to one of the king's most noble officials. Let them dress the man whom the king delights to honor. And let them lead on the horse through the square of the city, and proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom the king delights to honor. Now Haman is basically tipping his hand that he would like to be king. He wants to wear the king's clothing. He wants to have the king's horse. He wants to wear the king's crown. This guy is crazy. His ego is running amok. And so here he is, and he's thinking, what a great thing. And he could be paraded through the city. And the king said to Haman, well, hurry. Take the robes and the horse. Mordecai and Haman's like, yeah. And do as you said. And so do to Mordecai the Jew. Happy feeling gone. Completely gone. I would imagine right there he had tunnel vision. Things seemed like a million miles away from him now. He's just looking at the king in complete disbelief. In just a moment he was going to say, let's hang Mordecai. Now he's telling me to parade Mordecai through the city wearing the king's robes. Whose bright idea? Oh, that was my bright idea. That's right. So he says, so to Mordecai the Jew who sits at the king's gate, leave out nothing that you have mentioned. So Haman took the robes and the horse, and he dressed Mordecai and led him through the square of the city, proclaiming before him, thus shall it be done to the man whom delights, to whom the king delights to honor. Well, that's kind of how he probably would have said it. And he had to say it over and over and over and over again. Then Mordecai, in verse 12, returned to the king's gate. But Haman hurried to his house, mourning with his head covered. Now he's the one mourning. Remember, Mordecai was in mourning because his people were going to be executed, murdered. Now things have changed. Now it's Haman racing to his home to find comfort there. And Haman told his wife Zeresh and all of his friends everything that happened to him. Then his wise men and his wife Zeresh said to him, well, if Mordecai, before whom you have begun to fall, is of the Jewish people, you will not overcome him, but will surely fall before him. Their advice to him is completely different. Last night you told me to hang him. Now you're saying I'm the one that's going to be done in. And at that very moment, he's taken away and brought to the banquet. And next time that we look at Esther, we'll look at all of what is happening here. But basically, at the next banquet, Esther exposes Haman. And Haman is the one that is hung on those gallows. And Mordecai is exalted in the kingdom, and the Jewish people are delivered. It's important for us to kind of know the gist of the book, because something important has just happened here in this passage. And to fully understand it, we need to talk about the chiastic form. I know you're thinking, oh, now you're really excited, aren't you? I know, I can tell, I'm looking at you. You're all leaning forward now. Okay, lean forward. Okay, we're going to talk about the chiastic form. Say it, chiastic form. Oh, you're gonna like this. And if you don't, just tell me you do, okay? It's all right. It is a literary device. I know, that even makes it sound more appealing, doesn't it? It is a literary device that shows pattern when you're talking. And sometimes you take patterns and reverse them to emphasize a point, all right? And chiatic is from the word chi, which is an X symbol. Show the X symbol. That's the letter chi in the Greek alphabet. You know, when you see Christmas, sometimes people put Xmas. Well, that's an ancient way of doing that, because they would use X, chi, as Christ, because, you know, it was hard to write on scrolls. And sometimes they would just use an X for Christ. So that originally it was, you find a lot of old documents from the 1500s, 1400s, 1300s, 1200s with an X just meaning Christ. So there's a chi, and the AB, so what happens is there's an AB pattern and then a BA pattern. For instance, you've heard the phrase, you don't live to work, but what? You work to live. Okay, that's a chiastic form. See how that reverses, and it makes the point. Jesus actually liked using chiastic forms. Mark chapter 2, verse 27. And he said to them, the Sabbath was made for man, not man for the Sabbath. Okay, so the pattern is Sabbath for man, right? Sabbath for man. Sabbath for man. And not man for Sabbath. Okay, you got that? All right, another one that Jesus did. Matthew chapter 23, verse 12. Whoever exalts himself will be humbled, and whoever humbles himself will be exalted. So the first form is exalts himself will be humbled. So it's the reverse. Humbles himself will be exalted. So you see, it's an emphasis. So in order to understand the chiastic form, and you'll like this, because let me tell you, sometime this week, maybe somebody's going to use a chiastic form, and you can say, do you know you just used a chiastic form? You can do that. People think you are really smart, and you can say, well, I go to White Marsh Baptist Church. Of course I'm smart. All right? All right. So the chiastic form helps us understand what's going on in Esther. It's not, and we're going to look at the feast, the banquets in Esther. It's not truly a chiastic form, but it's very, very close. And it helps us to see the hinge, because we just read through the hinge of Esther. Okay, Esther starts off with two banquets, which will be represented by two plates. The first one is the king's banquet to begin the 180-day display of his wealth and his power. The second one is the king's seven-day banquet at the end of the 180-day display of his wealth and power to kind of convince people of how great he is. So it's really all about his authority. It's about his rule. It's about his wealth. And remember, he's trying to get everybody to follow him to attack Greece, which he did and lost. And then he comes back. Then there are two little sub-feasts that are dealing with the queens that we won't deal with. But then we come to the next one that interests us is the feast, the dinner, the banquet, really the private banquet between Haman and the king, signing of the decree to kill the Jews. So they had this, they talked, Haman convinced them that the Jews need to be killed. He agrees. They pick 11 months later to do it. So, and then they sit down and have a little drink and a meal together to celebrate what had just happened. So we have these banquets to show the king's power. Now Haman is exercising his authority. The next banquets that we see are the private banquets that Esther gave to the king and Haman. They're represented by even smaller plates. They're in a little intimate dinner. The first banquet Esther gave for the king and Haman. But at the second banquet Esther gave for the king and Haman, during which she denounces Haman. So remember, the king asked her, what do you want me to do? She says, well, if you come back tomorrow, I'll tell you. So the next banquet, she tells him. Then the next banquet that we see in the book of Esther is the public banquet given to elevate Mordecai to the rank of second only to the king. Haman's old job. Because now Haman has been executed. And Mordecai is now second in command. And Esther has been given all the property of Haman. And Esther has now given Mordecai authority over the property. Then the next two banquets we see, which are in gold plate, the banquets celebrating Jewish victory in the provinces, and then also the banquets celebrating Jewish victory in Susa. So there's a banquet that's celebrated throughout the provinces, and then there's a banquet in the capital city celebrating what the Jews have done. And really, it's not about the Jews have done, it's really about what God has done. And that's why we've used the gold plates to remind us of what God has done. Now, though you notice, the first two plates are about the greatness of Xerxes. The last two plates are about the greatness of God. The greatness of God, these banquets are the Purim banquets that are celebrated even today by the Jewish people for God's deliverance of the Jews in Persia. Even today, thousands and thousands of years later, they still celebrate those banquets. They're celebrating God's magnificent splendor and power. Nobody's celebrating Xerxes. So you see, there's a big contrast. But interesting, we start with the human royalty of a king, and we end with the royalty of God and what he has done. It's an amazing book, isn't it? So when we take a look at this, we're trying to find out what has happened. Where has the change come? And if we put that X over that, the chiatic form, we take a look at it, we see royalty celebrated, splendor celebrated, glory celebrated, and then royalty, splendor celebrated, but this time God's. We see a second in command, his dinner with the king. We see the new second in command, his public banquet. We see Esther having two banquets too. And in the middle, we see that something is, there's a hinge there. Something has changed. I kind of like this too. If you are familiar with music, if we put the triangles up, the first one is a decrescendo, which means as you're playing music, you're supposed to get softer like that. And then you have a crescendo, which means that as you are playing, you get a little bit louder for emphasis. And so you kind of see that there, a decrescendo from the earthly powers and earthly schemes to a crescendo of what God is doing. So something happened, and something happened in between those two banquets. Esther could have said at that first banquet and denounce Haman. Haman's a bad guy. You should get rid of him. But something told her not to do it. Now, she's been praying. She's been fasting. She's been seeking God's will. There's something that was within her that decided she was not going to denounce Haman at that banquet. She was going to wait 24 hours. And most people would say, now, why did you wait? You had this golden opportunity. Why on the earth did you wait? Well, what happened? Well, the entire passage, the entire book of Esther hinges on Xerxes' insomnia. And that is a God thing. Everything in this book hinges because Xerxes couldn't go to sleep. I don't know if he had too much coffee. I don't know what it is, but he was tossing and turning. You ever wake up in the middle of the night with things on your mind? And you're going, wow. You know, and there may be times that God is waking us up to get our attention. And sometimes maybe we should kind of think, all right, God, am I awake because you want me awake, or am I awake because I'm worrying? And there are times that when you're in the middle of the night and you actually are asking God to show you something, that might be the golden moment. Because while all the things that are going on between these two banquets, look what happened. Haman, his ego is going nuts. And Xerxes can't sleep. And he's reviewing his chronicles. He's reviewing all the good deeds. He's reviewing things to make him feel better about himself. And as he's trying to feel better about himself, he recognizes he didn't honor the guy who saved his life. And he wanted to do something about that. So here God kept him awake and let him look through his thing and came to the issue of Mordecai. So everything that we see here hinges right on that moment. It didn't hinge on Esther accepting God's role, because Mordecai already said God's going to deliver his people whether you're a part of it or not. It wasn't because she threw the banquet for them, though that did help set the stage a little bit for God to work behind the scenes. But the real issue here is what God did with Xerxes, changing Xerxes' heart, working in Xerxes to see the reality of what's going on. So what do we learn? Well, drink more coffee in the evening and you'll hear from God, right? No. Well, maybe. No. What do we learn? Well, Esther made the big decision to seek God's will in Esther 4. She didn't want to. She was afraid. Remember, she's afraid. Little girl, afraid. But then she decided she's going to seek God's will. And she started changing. There was transformation in her life. And she went, and the king held out a scepter to her. That meant that she was safe. And he asked her, "What would you like?" And she said, "I'd like for you to come to dinner." Didn't say anything about Haman. At dinner, king's feeling really good. Good wine, good food. And he says, "What would you like?" She said, "I'd like you to come back. Bring Haman too." You see, she made the big decision, but Esther also lived out the decision to follow God in each of her additional decisions. And this is important. Remember, when we talk about the definition of discernment, it's an increasing capacity to recognize and respond to the presence of God, both in the ordinary moments of our lives and in the major decisions we make along the way. Okay, she made a big decision. Really, up until she was challenged by Mordecai to do something about the Jewish people, we don't see anything that's really indicating that she's very pious. Then she makes this decision that she's going to follow God. Do whatever he says. We kind of see a conversion moment. And then what happens? Then she lived out that decision to follow God in all the additional decisions that she made. So she made a big decision to follow God's will in Esther 4. And then she lived out the decisions to follow God in each of her additional decisions. Go ahead and hit the slide. So here she's making those major decisions in her life to follow God, and then she follows those minor decisions. That's what it means to discern. And then we make kingdom decisions in the major issues and the ordinary issues of life. You know, when we come to a place in our life that we recognize that we're sinners, that we need Christ, we confess Him as our Lord and our Savior, that's a big decision. That means that we go from being an enemy of God to a friend of God. That means that we go from perishing to being saved. That means that we go from an eternity separated from God to an eternity present with God. That's a big decision. But we also need to recognize that all the other decisions that we make, a lot of the decisions that we make in life are kingdom decisions also. Now, I'm not talking about necessarily should you wear the purple shirt or the burgundy and gold shirt. I'm not talking about those decisions. Though what might be written on a shirt might be a decision to take in consideration. But I think that if we were to really be honest with ourselves and we think about each of our day, that we would, be, if somebody were to say, hey, did you make kingdom decisions this week? Probably a lot of us would say, eh, no, not really. I just made these ordinary everyday decisions. But kingdom decisions reflect the intersection of God's rule, his will, and the presence of Christ in our hearts. So there are a lot of these little decisions that we think are no problem or no biggie or no big deal that maybe were a big deal. Okay, think about it. Esther decides, okay, I don't think I'm going to tell him about Haman yet. I think I'll wait one more day. I'm sure if somebody found out she did that, if Mordecai, maybe Mordecai would have been disappointed in her. But that was that moment that was a big deal, because did she know that the king wasn't going to sleep that night? She didn't know that. Did she know that Haman was going to run into Mordecai and kind of have an egomaniacal attack, just going, oh my goodness, you know, everybody else bows down to me, but not this guy? Was she going to know that Haman was going to build gallows to hang Mordecai? She didn't know any of that. All she knew is, I think we'll do it. I think we should meet one more time. And we are faced with decisions every single week that are kingdom decisions, but I think part of the time they just get away from us. We don't recognize them because they don't seem like they're big deals. It is about personal discernment and practicing that. It's personal discernment's described this way, that God granted ability to distinguish, to discriminate between the good, something of God, which draws us towards God, and the evil, something not of God, drawing us away from God when we make decisions. So there's something that draws us to God and something that draws us away from God. In our area around us, and even within our own church, there are times that when it's raining on Sunday morning, people make the decision, I'm not going to go to church today. It's raining. Now, that doesn't seem like a big deal until you kind of step back and what does it actually mean? Because it's raining, water's dropping out from the sky. Because it's raining, I am choosing that going and gathering with brothers and sisters in Christ together to come and worship God, the creator, the sustainer of all that there is, to spend time with them, recognizing what Jesus Christ has done in our lives, and to celebrate Jesus Christ, and to also recognize that in this crazy world that we live in, that I have this opportunity to gather with fellow citizens of the kingdom. I'm going to not do that because it's raining. That is a kingdom decision that goes contrary to the kingdom of God. It could be anything that we are spending time in at work. People spending time gossiping about an employee. The decision that we have to make is, do I join in with that gossip and add my 2 cents? Or do I refrain? Or maybe I say, well, I know that there might be some issues there, but you know, this person does do this. We have opportunities all the time to make a difference for God. But it's those little tiny decisions, those split-second decisions that we make that either take us closer to God or take us further away from God. It's personal discernment practices in the ordinary moments. And so it is really up to us to stop and allow God to work in such a way that he will remind us that in some of these decisions that don't seem like a big deal are a big deal. And even making a small little decision gives us an opportunity to really align ourselves with what God is already planning on doing. And I don't know what decisions that you might have made in the last week or two that now that you look back, maybe you go, wow, that was a kingdom decision and I blew it. Or maybe there's a kingdom decision and you say, well, God, I didn't realize it was going to be what it was, but I praise you for aligning my life with your will. You know, oftentimes we focus on what we missed, but we also need to recognize when we respond correctly. Because in both those instances is where we learn to be more Christ-like. In both those instances, we learn more about aligning ourselves with God's will. And I don't know what decisions you're going to face tomorrow or during the week or within the next month. But the next time you're tempted to say, well, you know, this is no biggie, I want you to stop and think, well, maybe it is. Maybe this is something I need to pay more attention to. Maybe God's doing something and I'm just not paying any attention because I'm just dismissing this one decision in my life. The book of Esther isn't really about the war, you know, about the people of Israel being delivered and fighting their way out. It's about that one moment in the middle of the night when the entire history, the entire fate of the Jewish people hinged from going from perishing to being redeemed. And it's just in that moment. I don't know what that moment is for you this week, but I pray that God will reveal that to you and that when you look at it and go, okay, God, I don't fully understand why I should do this, but I'm going to do it because I'm going to trust you. That's my prayer, is that you would do that.